For all of you out there who don't know me, get ready. Because you're about to know me.
Hello, I'm Martin Kessler, and on this episode, I'm joined by filmmaker Eugene Kotliarenko to talk about his new movie, Spree, which is a dark satire. I think is maybe the best way to describe it. I think the film's really great. We're probably not going to get into anything too spoilery, but I would recommend definitely going seeing the film off the bat if you're listening to this.
And I recommend seeing it even if you're not listening to this.
Just recommendations all around. Yeah, it's a film that I think it's very funny. It's very entertaining. It also made me feel bad, which I think is a good thing for this sort of film. I guess part of the critique in it is of social media culture, which I felt a little bit complacent in while watching because, of course, I have a podcast and a Twitter and this and that. And a little bit of the film's criticism, I think, is targeted at that need for attention that kind of comes along with this social media
economy, participation that we have in this sort of economy, right? That we don't really want to think of as an economy, but it most certainly is with hawks and victims and losers and winners and all that stuff.
I'm Twitter middle class, I think, with my number of followers. That's sort of where I'm falling into.
Well, I think that it is like an oligarchy in a way, right? Where basically there are the influencers, quote unquote, who have the oligarchy, and then everyone else is basically lumping proles and irrelevant. And, you know, the movie, right, is tracking a person who has felt irrelevant and basically non-existent because of that in terms of identity, in terms of any sort of power that they might have or meaning that they might have in the culture or even existentially. So you're following that sort of person at a moment in their life when they feel like, oh, I finally seized upon the shortcut to virality, to relevance, to existing. And that shortcut is very dark and evil and twisted.
Absolutely. The character's name is Kurt Kunkel, and he's played by Joe Keery, right?
Yeah.
His performance is really fantastic. He's sort of, on one hand, feels like that bottomless pit kind of human being who sort of speaks in cliches and speaks in things that he thinks will get him attention. But there's sort of a strange earnestness in his performance, too, that I think makes you see the character at times as pathetic.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the character is going on a murderous rampage. Let's just say it, you know. I don't know how long we can talk about the film without just putting that out there, that he basically is, you know, live streaming his murderous rampage as a way to get attention and followers and views. And, you know, that is his big idea. And because he's presenting it as a tutorial, you know, and the movie is presented almost as a live stream tutorial on how to go viral, and he's so oblivious to the immoral and horrific nature of his deeds, and he's just coming from a place of pure, like, help. I'm helping viewers. There's a humor to that obliviousness, a very dark humor, but there's also, like, a built-in pathos to the performance because he is so oblivious and so desperate. And so I guess when you're transparent in that way, where, you know, anyone can see your sort of desperate craving for something that you can't attain, that inherently will engender sympathy, even if the behavior that you're engaging in is horrific, you know? And then that the film sort of, you know, walks that line and explores that sort of audience sympathy very intentionally. Like, you know, the first three passengers that he picks up are arguably more morally reprehensible than him. And so, you know, you have to, as a viewer, you have to ask yourself, like, well, is it okay if he kills a white supremacist? Maybe I feel good about that. Oh, is it okay if he kills, like, a sort of gentrifying real estate agent? Maybe I feel good about that, you know? And at what point are you going to stop feeling okay with him killing people?
Right. That first section with those three passengers, that reminded me a little bit of the satire from the 90s, The Last Supper, the Stacy Title film. I don't know if you've seen
it. I've actually never seen that.
It's got a really great Ron Perlman performance in it about these students who decide that they're going to start murdering people who could hypothetically be the next Hitler or very right-wing people who they consider dangerous. And it goes into a very interesting direction, I think. And that's a film that I think is maybe a little bit underrated.
You know, there's been, since COVID started, there's been a sort of proliferation of live streaming sort of throwback movie channels, like in the style of early HBO or the Z channel. So there's one called The Cinephobe that I really like, and there's one called Cathode Cinema, and there's one called MoviePast. And so today, actually, we're doing a whole day of movies that influence Spree. So Last Supper, I've actually never seen that, but I'll give you a quick rundown, and you let me know if any of these stuck out to you. So if I can remember it from memory. The first one is this M. Night Shyamalan film, The Visit. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, of that, course.
An extremely cringy film that actually pulls off its found footage, or, you know, sort of like, we are documenting our experience in a really interesting and fun way. Then A Face in the Crowd.
Oh, okay.
You know, that film, the Ilya Kazan film about the sort of itinerant criminal musician who becomes a demagogue, America's most popular person. And then, you know how you said in your intro that the film made you feel really bad? One of the, I think that's definitely in the DNA of the movie for sure. So the next movie is called Satan's Brew.
I haven't actually seen it. I've seen a bunch of Fassbender. That's a blind spot for me.
There's like a very manic energy in that film, which I think Spree also has. And there's a really sort of like scathing critique, which ultimately feels like a kind of dismal bummer, which I think is also in the DNA of Spree. No, yeah, it's a really good movie. And then there's a movie called Payday, about a country musician played by Rip Torn on tour being the worst type of monster. Just a sort of musician on his high horse, just completely taking advantage of his employees and groupies and his family and all this stuff. And it's very disgusting. His behavior is disgusting. Then a late Brian De Palma film called Passion. Have you seen that?
Yes, I've seen Passion with Noemi Rapace.
Exactly. Yeah. I think Rachel McAdams. And it's a really underrated film. I think that's what happens to kind of a lot of De Palma films. They come out, people are like, we don't like this. We don't get this. This is stupid. And then 10 years later, people realize it's awesome. It has a lot of actually really good techno thriller elements that are really, out of all of those sort of new Hollywood filmmakers, I think De Palma is really the only one who continued being extremely innovative in his filmmaking, just in terms of form and style and visual literacy. Like, he always kept pushing it. So that's the first half of the day. There's more.
That's a great bunch already.
So then we get into the really scary movies for nighttime. So that movie Angst.
Oh, yeah.
That's another intense bummer. That's Satan's Brew and Angst are the two movies I can remember seeing, being so blown away by and feeling so horrible after they were over. I was like, I don't know that I can, I can't really function right now. It's very rare. I mean, I love movies, but, you know, those stick out to me. Then a Hong Kong Category 3 film called The Untold Story. You know, Category 3 Hong Kong films, those are like the equivalent of like X-rated films.
Yes.
They are, you know, extreme by nature. And this movie is one of kind of the most notorious ones about a serial killer. But it's extremely goofy and also just beyond the pale. This specific duo, the actor and filmmaker behind this, they made a few films that are just really beyond normal morality. And then after that, we're showing Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Of course, that's, I definitely thought of watching, watching Spree,
Just the mix between low humor and disturbing humor and just this examination of a inscrutable type of personality. And the last movie, really late night movie, is called The Road Movie. Do you remember that came out a few years ago? It's a basically poetically, artistically minded compilation of Russian dash cam videos.
Okay, I haven't seen this, but that also sounds fantastic. I thought a little bit of Taxi Tehran.
I know. I'm honestly, I gotta be 100% honest. I think it's too late because I've already jumbled the schedule up so much. But earlier, right before we got on the call, I was like, fuck, should I email the MoviePass people and just be like, can we swap out Payday for Taxi Tehran? Because that also is a really influential movie on myself and the writer. And that's a Jafar Panahi movie for anyone who's listening. And, you know, he was banned from making films by the Iranian government. So he made a film called This Is Not a Movie. And his second sort of, you know, underground, illegal, illicit film is called Taxi. And it's him in a sort of black cab going around the city documenting his pickups. And, you know, people recognize him and some people don't. And you don't know what's real and what's performed. And it's a really brilliant and very creative filmmaking kind of style that he came up with in there. And a wonderful movie that I wish I had been smart enough to program 3 days ago when I was doing all this. But it really was influential for sure.
That sounds like a really great bunch and just interesting influences. Yeah, I was really curious because it seems like a film that you're drawing on certain formal aspects, but you're arranging things in this really interesting way with the, I think of it as the computer screen presentation, which it's really a combination of things. There's some cell phone style footage. There's Twitch streaming style footage.
It's a little bit past sort of the sort of screen grabbed computer dynamic. So this is my fifth film, maybe even like sixth film, depending on how you count them. And my first two movies were that. They were computer screen movies. I made them in 2010. And they, you know, you're stuck kind of on the desktop. And I took a break from that language a little bit for whatever, a decade. And then when I made Spree, I was like, okay, time to push this to the next level. So Spree is very dynamic. So it is all captured, you know, stuff through social media, right? But it's also, you know, live streamed. So his dad, you're not, what I'm saying is you're not trapped to a desktop, right? You know, he's got all the dash cams set up in the car and he's using his smartphone. And so through those two sort of, you know, moving, those two are, you know, are literally vehicles for kind of like dynamic storytelling. But at the same time, we had to create a visual language that adhered to certain formal, you know, limitations and principles of basically live streaming or a reconstructed live stream. And so, yeah, it did have to, you know, I kind of call it like found footage 2.0.
Right. I mean, that makes sense because that's how I think a lot of media is consumed right now. And I think for me, especially right now, that the movie theaters are shut down and that I'm self-isolating, it sort of feels like that's my main connection to reality is through these sorts of screens, and that's how I interact with people. So that, I think, hit especially hard watching the film. It's like, oh yeah, this feels more real in a way than a lot of other films I've been watching this year. And even though the characters are acting in this sort of heightened way, I sort of think back and I'm like, well, that is how people interact online, and that is how a lot of my social interactions do kind of end up. And you know, some of these things that certain characters say, they sound so outlandish, but you really don't have to look hard to find people actually saying these things online. It's sort of easy to fall down those rabbit holes.
No, yeah, I'm glad you're acknowledging that. I think one of the hang-ups on the film that people have is that they, you know, we're so grounded in what we think is realism or realistic performance. And clearly the formal and visual language of the film sort of foregrounds this idea of I'm watching reality. But part of what I think about when I say the term found footage 2.0 is that the presentation and the aesthetic should make you feel, wow, it feels like it's really happening. But at the same time, we're so far along in this sort of like arc of found footage films that we know it's not really happening. Like, you know, as a viewer, you balance both of those bits of, wow, it feels like it's real. And it's like, of course this isn't real. It's a fucking movie, you know? And along with that goes, you know, sort of stylized performances and stylized writing. And I think one thing that unites all of those, a lot of those films that I mentioned, is that there's an expressionistic quality to the performances in all of those films. And for better or worse, you know, and same thing with Spree, like, you know, it's a anthropomorphization of online behavior. I mean, that's what this film is. And so the people in it, the characters in it are almost like archetypes of stuff that you would find online. You know, I'm a big fan of the sort of outlandish, as you said, nature of the performances, but a lot of people get hung up on it. Because they're like, who would ever say incel in real life? I'm like, well, it doesn't matter. Real life is increasingly, real life is virtual life.
Yeah, I think that absolutely comes across. It was interesting you referencing De Palma earlier. One thing I really liked were the split screens. And it sort of made me think how I'll have several tabs open. Like I do right now, I've got the Skype tab and I've got my notes and I've got a little IMDb opened up and, you know, things like that, which it makes me think that, yeah, maybe the real way to represent some of these online experiences isn't through realism as a technique, but that you can do something a little bit more expressive or stylish. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you think about De Palma, right, kind of innovating in that sort of split screen space, and you have other sort of pioneers like Peter Greenaway or, you know, it's definitely littered throughout cinema history, these sort of split screens, especially in American avant-garde did a lot of exploration of that too. And, you know, they really are, avant-garde is actually the right word, because they're ahead of a certain type of visual literacy, right? And you do have people like De Palma who truly brought it into a sort of commercial narrative space, right? Where he's like, okay, I can actually figure out ways to have this elevate the tension or the suspense or the information for the viewer. But now that we have developed, you know, between 10 and 20 years of human beings or, you know, whatever, anyone who's, you know, using devices has developed a certain visual literacy that demands attention on multiple screens simultaneously. At this point, it seems actually like necessary and or natural and not novel, but actually, you know, just natural to use this type of visual storytelling to get across anything to your audience. Any scene could be done in this way, expanding the language of cinema into a language that we now get, that they might not have understood when Sisters or Carrie or even like Peter Greenaway Pillow Book or whatever came out, we were doing all these split screens. Now it's almost necessary to maintain people's attention in a way that they're used to. And so, like I said, in my first film, Zeros and Ones and Skydiver, I explored that, and to a lesser extent in my other films. Then here, I sort of, I'm trying to kind of revisit that and expand how it works, because, you know, the whole second half of the movie has all these comments, right? Because he's live streaming and he suddenly has a big following. And so you have this endless stream of comments that I think are really enjoyable if you're able to process the comments and the, you know, sort of surface live stream film. You can get a lot more out of the movie if you can sort of dialectically synthesize them, right? I mean, if you, even nowadays in 2020, you watch a movie where a character is sending a text message, and often it will be, you know, just the classic sort of close up on their face and then insert shot of their POV on their device. And you don't need that. You can maintain both of those image feeds at the same time and probably get more for a viewer between watching someone's face as they type and seeing what they're typing or what they're reading. You can get more from your audience emotionally, psychologically. You can give them more informationally from putting those two things up simultaneously. And that's something I think, you know, is fun and spree. And just on a pure De Palma Hitchcock level or whatever, you know, the scene of him driving to someone's house and, you know, setting up that house and setting up the expectation of what's going to happen and then sort of subverting it. And similarly, you know, Jesse Adams, right, who is the sort of protagonist or antagonist, depending on how you think of the film, of the movie, played by Sashir Zameda. Her catchphrase, right, she's like the functional version of Kurt. You know, she's like the quote-unquote good Kurt, you know. And she has a catchphrase, right? All eyes on me, I want to be seen. And so she's a comedian. So at her comedy shows, when she says that, that's the cue for them to take out their phones. So I knew we were going to set up this thing where Kurt is at the show and you're going to be cutting between all the different POVs of the phones documenting the show. And, you know, Kurt has a very scary scheme when he goes to her show. And so sort of trying to generate tension in the style of like, you know, The Man Who Knew Too Much, where as a viewer, you know that when the certain little timpani hits at the opera house, something, it's the signal for something really bad to happen, but you don't know when that is, you know, in the song. And similarly, like, you know, being able to cut between all of these almost first-person shooter POVs, but they're really just documenting her show. And then every once in a while, cutting to Kurt and wondering whether or not he would, you know, kill her, is kind of, those are my two big kind of like homage or, you know, definitely sequences when I was thinking about De Palma and Hitchcock a lot. I've always had an affinity for kind of maximalist filmmakers, you know, Maxwell Fools is someone that I really like. But yeah, I think also, you know, it's always refreshing. Like, you know, one thing that Fassbinder is extremely good at compositionally is layering his space, you know, foreground, yes, midground, background. And I think there's a lot of visual information to present, you can present through that. I mean, Renoir was really good at that too. And I think, like, not to keep going back to my earliest projects, but I think Spree is like a sort of reimagining and revivification of some of these sort of explorations cinematically. Like, I was trying in my first movie, Zeros and Ones, to figure out ways to present visual information through different layers, but flatten it. So, like, in the way that in a Renoir film or a Fassbinder or a Welles film, you can, or whatever, or Tsai Ming-Liang or whatever, Edward Yang. Like, you know, these are people who really know how to work with space. And then 10 years ago, I was kind of obsessed with medieval art. I felt like the way that they thought about a piece of art as a place you enter, right? Like, it's almost like another dimension, but it almost is like a window. And so there's, like, this flattening happening. Is kind of how we was our relationship to our screens, our computers, and our phones. They have all of this sort of metaphorical information, like a desktop or folders or whatever. These are all metaphors created to sort of make sense of a virtuality that otherwise would just be numbers and like command lines and shit. So yeah, so I was trying to figure out a way to kind of have a flattened maximalist space. And I think with Spree, similarly, I'm just interested in not necessarily depth, you know, in terms of visual information, foreground, middle ground, background, but sort of like a flattened, hyper maximalized, you know, composition.
Right.
You know, it's funny. I think also people are going to listen to this conversation and they're going to watch the movie and they're going to be like, wow, what a dumb fucking movie. but you know what, like, to me, I think it's actually really important to entertain people, and I think it's important, yeah, to, I love art that explores different registers of humor, and I think sometimes people have a hard time accepting sort of maybe conceptual humor mixed with lowbrow humor, mixed with body humor, mixed with whatever, commentary, you know, social commentary or something. Unless you're on its wavelength, one of those things is not going to sit right with you, you know?
Right. And I think satirical films, there's a long history of maybe not being acknowledged by critics or accepted immediately. I was looking at some of the reviews for Spree, and some of it, it's like, oh, these characters are dumb, therefore the movie's dumb. And it's like, no, like, clearly the character isn't the point of view that you're supposed to be looking at this movie from. And oh, like, it made me feel bad, therefore it's bad. It's like, no, that's...
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, satire very, yeah, as often, because what it's doing is making people uncomfortable about literally the world that they live in and that they engage with and that they participate in. And the first thing they want to do when they see it is be like, that's not me.
Right. And just talking about films as entertainment, like, I don't know, I really like Paul Verhoeven's films. And
it's definitely. Like,
on one hand, you have to explain to people like, oh yeah, no, this movie that's very entertaining where a guy gets his dick shot off is also like really smart. Trust me, it's
100%. I mean,
you're like, no, it's good.
He's really definitely one of my top filmmakers. And thinking about movies like, you know, I mean, I like them all. I like his Dutch movies. I like his latest movies. But you think explicitly about movies like RoboCop and like Starship Troopers and like Hollow Man, and these are clearly scathing critiques of the society that they portray and of the cultural moment that generated them. And in fact, maybe even a cultural, maybe they're a little bit ahead of the cultural moment in a weird way. You know, like in a way, like RoboCop seems like it's this like takedown of a certain type of like Reaganism. But in fact, maybe that movie's 10 years in advance. And it's all about the way that, you know, technology systems infiltrate a certain kind of political morality. Same thing with Starship Troopers. Imagine that movie came out 4 years later or 5 years later after the invasion of Iraq in reaction to 9/11. In 1997, watching Starship Troopers, you're like, this is so fascistic and stupid. Why would they create this all this war imagery and whatever? It's like, no, you dummy. It's actually like a critique of American and, you know, sort of Western militarism or militarism in general. And they're like, well, that's not our society. It doesn't matter. It's like, it is your society. You just, it's not foregrounded in your mind right now. Same way as people who watch Spree, they're like, this is, everything this movie's saying is super obvious. Well, if it was fucking super obvious, you wouldn't be tweeting your critique of it. You'd be off fucking Twitter. If it was super obvious to you that social media and your desire to participate in the attention economy was turning you into an amoral, sociopathic person, even if you're a good version of that, like Jesse Adams, you wouldn't fucking be on it. So it's not obvious, you know? Right. Sorry to get so worked up.
No, and I think like the Jesse Adams character, Sashir Zameda's character, she's sort of that lifeline to have some kind of reflection on, okay, maybe like it's okay to shut off the screen once in a while, not check my phone, turn it off, you know. And I mean, I think like a lot of good things do come out of social media, and I really have met people that I've made friends with in real life over social media and made connections and made opportunities and jobs. But at the same time, you have to understand it's a whole culture.
I mean, it is the culture now. It's not like a culture. It's not subcultural. It is the way we process our relationships and our identity and our self-worth. I mean, like, obviously there are the old ways of finding love and affection and joy and all these things, and I hope they sustain and continue. But by and large, people have very thoughtlessly and very addictively, you know, signed off their consciousness into this contract of virtualizing meaning and value. And it's really scary to me. And I'm not saying I'm above it. I'm saying I'm a, you know, participant. And I, you know, Jesse Adams, who is probably the most sane character in the movie, is basically sane because she knows how to manipulate the system, and she knows how to work it, and she knows how to kind of talk about it and maybe even critique it in a way that still will generate attention for her. You know, one of the greatest tricks the devil ever pulled was saying he was going off of social media. Like, I mean, that, you know, that's, you know, a tried and true technique for getting attention. I'm going off social media. I'm back, you know, like,
well, I don't want to, again, spoil anything, but like the very ending of the film.
Right.
There's a moment where I thought she was going to turn off the camera, and instead she does something a little bit different.
I mean, that is sort of like the final moral decision of the film. Yes. And the coda of the film sort of summarizes the aftermath of that decision.
And it's like the reason why Kurt becomes fixated on her is she has what he wants. He wants those followers. He wants those eyes on him. He feels entitled to that attention.
It's almost like his attention is shifts, right? Because one character we haven't mentioned, who I think is really good in the film, is Bobby, the influencer, Bobby Basecamp, played by Josh Ovi. And, you know, that's Kurt's lifeline, if you will, for most of his life, this little kid that he babysitted, who then became like a successful kind of fuckboy influencer. And once that person exits the film, you know, Jesse becomes sort of a new fixation. And, you know, there's a whole sort of like arc to that fixation that shifts. So when Kurt shifts, I mean, to me, the scariest part of the movie, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, but whatever, watch the fucking movie. It's not talking about a movie. I hate spoilers personally. I even try to avoid trailers, but you know, talking about a movie, and when I hear someone saying, oh, I'm about to talk about something, I just skip that part. So if you're listening, you can just skip this part. But when he stops wanting to kill Jesse and he starts wanting to love Jesse, like, that's the scariest part to me. And he's like, we're in love, like, you know, real love, not fake love and stuff. And that, when you see a sociopathic person online who has been spewing either vitriolic stuff or just a lot of haterade or just things that feel really negative, suddenly shift and be like, well, my new brand is love. Like, I'm all about love now. Like, there's one specific online personality I'm thinking of that did this, and I was, you know, observing it and being like, holy shit, this is scary. And it's a great way to get away with whatever rebranding, you know, to say, I'm all about love now. I'm all about positivity. Like, you know, people are just going to use whatever signal they can for more attention.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the idea in the film that's explored is how, yeah, maybe the social media might produce a psychopath, but it all kind of turns us into like little mini sociopaths to some degree.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying that anyone watching the film would have the ideas of Kurt Kunkel. And obviously I'm trying to make fun. I mean, very explicitly, I'm trying to make fun of people like Elliot Rodgers, like, you know, the Virginia Tech mass murderer and a lot of these other guys who have really twisted and demented ideas that they believe come from some sort of, you know, ideological standpoint or, you know, sort of like justice. Like, Elliot Rodgers thought he was coming from a place of like personal justice. And it's just really clear how they're just driven by attention. They just want to be central in a narrative. And so I'm trying to make fun of those people, but I'm also trying to say, hey, there's a little bit of Kurt in all of us, you know, and I that's the part I think that makes people uncomfortable. I mean, even Kurt in the first scene with the white supremacist, when he's like, being racist is toxic, you know?
Right.
It's not that Kurt is like militantly anti-racist. It's that he is signaling that he understands that the economy of social media does not reward racism.
He doesn't want this racist stuff on his stream is basically what it boils down to.
It would jeopardize his potential virality.
Right.
Or the type of virality that he wants. And I think there's a lot of that going on, just sort of like the signaling of like, hey, I believe in the right things without actually practicing or truly believing in them.
Right. The way we sort of curate our opinions. And I know like people call it virtue signaling and that sort of thing.
I mean, let's get into how we connected. You online, I saw someone, we connected online.
Yes.
I saw someone retweet.
See, it can't be all bad.
Yeah, it can't be all bad. No, I saw someone retweet your tweet about Goya's Ghosts, the Milos Forman film, which I really dig and I really like, and I've been thinking about it and telling everyone about it for years now, and it gave your sort of savvy understanding of the Javier Bardem character as this sort of snake who's able to sort of weave his way through all these different political upheavals and still come out kind of on top. And allowed me to sort of like start pontificating on like and analyzing why that movie failed when really it's very relevant and why no one knows about it when really everyone should, blah, blah. And that's sort of how we connected. But that movie, I think beyond the sort of surface analysis I gave, which is like a poster and it's like Goya's autobiography starring Javier Bardem. And like, could anything be cooler and sexier and smarter than that? And then you show up to the movie and it's like actually like doughy, pasty Stellan Skarsgård as Goya. And Javier Bardem is like some random evil priest or whatever. Beyond that, I think another reason the movie just flopped in its initial release was that people are uncomfortable being shown moments in history where the exploiters win and quote-unquote good people suffer. And, you know, that's more often than not the case because the people who crave power and people who sort of uphold, you know, a one-dimensional view of morality are oftentimes corrupt and immoral themselves, you know, and people are uncomfortable with that idea. And also the movie has some very campy kind of stylized performative elements that I think, we, you know, kind of what we were talking about earlier, where whatever. And you know what's funny about naturalism and realism? It's very culturally specific. What might seem, you know, naturalistic in a Nigerian film or an Indian Bollywood film. When I say Nigerian, I mean sort of like the commercial cinema of Nigeria, like Nollywood and Bollywood. Or it might have seemed natural in Hollywood in the year 1951 is very different than what we think is natural in 2020 in America or in Western Europe or in Japan. You know, it's all specific to time and place. And so I'm always just about what is the fun performance? What's the performance that is dynamic that I can watch? You know, like Jimmy Cagney probably doesn't feel good in, you know, 1952, which is why he didn't make movies in the 50s. I mean, he retired on his own accord.
Shows up in another Milos Forman film that nobody talks about.
Yeah, Ragtime.
Yeah.
I mean, I think actually one of his greatest performances is basically his last one before Ragtime, 1, 2, 3, the Billy Wilder film.
That's a really great film.
Great movie, great performance, and Billy Wilder understood like the glory and power of Cagney, and so he found a way to bring it back.
Okay, so you guys may be the first to shoot a man to the moon, but if he wants a Coke on the way, you'll have to come to us.
It's nice talking about movies with you. I mean...
Yeah, well, thank you for coming on, and I'm not sure if there's anything else you wanted to mention or if that pretty much covers it. I thought that was really great.
No, it's my pleasure to come on. It's great talking with you. I'm glad that, you know, we could talk about Spree and all these other sort of a kind of cinematic issues and ideas and excitements. And I hope that your listeners check out the movie.
I watched it. I mean, I found out about the film when I clicked on your Twitter and it was pinned right at the top. So
it's on my Twitter, guy. And you know what? One thing we didn't mention is check out KurtzWorld96. On Instagram. Have you seen that?
Oh, no.
We had a highly, well, when I say successful, it's relative, but we basically got 80,000 followers for a, almost like making a second movie. It was like an augmented reality performance that myself and a few other people were doing as Kurt with all sorts of additional content that Joe and I shot in character. And it felt to these 80,000 followers who are largely teenagers. You know, I think the movie has huge, quote-unquote, clout and impact with teenagers, probably because of a combination of Stranger Things fans and this, you know, very successful Instagram account. And we had like a 350,000 follower TikTok account, blah, blah. I mean, it's funny to talk about these numbers, but, you know, we're talking about the lifeblood of a film, you know. And so for me, there's like a greater good to trying to sort of game the system. Because especially in this film, I wouldn't do it for like every film, but this film is such a critique and such a takedown of social media behavior and economy and all that, that it felt like the only way to really do it is to try to go viral. And so we did.
Yeah, that feels very appropriate for this.
Yeah, so people can check that out. Like, if you've seen the film, I'm sure you will be very intrigued by the KurtzWorld 96 content, which I think is really funny and almost like making a second movie. And, you know, I think part of the point of a conversation like this is to expand the base or the potential viewership of the film beyond, you know, 14 to 23-year-olds. So hopefully we can hook in a few people, and it's been really awesome getting to know you, man.
Cool. Thank you very much, and take care. And for anyone listening, take care, and yeah, check out the film.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye. Stay safe, COVID heads.
If you're not documenting yourself, you just don't exist.